You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. So I just have to say that it would have been such a dream to present Elizabeth Alexander by herself. It would have been such a dream, and it's been such a dream for such a long time to present Kevin Young. But to have them here together is like a double rainbow. It is really, we are really blessed. So I just want you to, I want us all to count our blessings. Many of you, I'm sure, first encountered Elizabeth Alexander's poetry on the day of President Obama's inauguration, when her poem, Praise Song for the Day, resounded throughout the Capitol and really throughout the world. In today's sharp sparkle, this winter air, anything can be made, any sentence begun. On the brink, on the brim, on the cusp, praise song for walking forward in that light. The light and the praise both these poets bring to our ears and our heart, their acknowledgement of grief, pain of love, is deeply appreciated as we walk forward in these times trying to find the light. Elizabeth Alexander is the author of 6 books of poetry, 2 collections of essays, a play, and various edited collections. She was recently named a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, as well as the Mellon Professor of Humanities at Columbia University. She was the inaugural Frederick Iseman Professor of Poetry at Yale, where she taught for 15 years and chaired the African American Studies Department. Her memoir, The Light of the World, from which she'll be reading tonight, which is one of the most compelling memoirs I've ever read, is a deeply felt meditation on the blessings of love, family, art, and community. You finish reading it, you want to start reading it again. Kevin Young's new collection of poems, Blue Laws, Selected and Uncollected Poems, 1995 to 2015, is a great event to celebrate tonight. Yes. Its epigraph comes from Lightnin' Hopkins: playing the blues in the old days was like being black twice. Read as a whole, critic Christine Smallwood noted in Harper's, the book tells a story about how history has been written on African-American bodies and imagines the voices that have spoken back, language forms like new skin, tender and tough. Poems and Blue Laws are gathered from the first 20 years of an extraordinary career. Kevin Young is the author of 11 books of poetry and prose, including Book of Hours, winner of the Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize, Ardency, a Chronicle of the Amistad Rebels, winner of a 2012 American Book Award, and Jelly Roll, a blues finalist for the National Book Award. He's currently the Charles Howard Candler Professor of Creative Writing and English and curator of both literary collections and the Raymond Donowski Poetry Library at Emory University in Atlanta. It gives me great pleasure to please welcome Elizabeth Alexander and Kevin Young. Please join me.
So hi, everybody. I'm going to read first. I'm really, really, really happy to be here. Thank you for organizing such a beautiful event. It's always wonderful to come and share your work, but to share it with one of my dearest friends and one of my fellow travelers on this kooky road that we've been walking together for a really, really long time is a joy, is really a joy. So I'm glad to be here. I'm a poet, but I wrote a memoir. I didn't think that I was going to do it. I thought it was unseemly for someone at my particular stage of life to put her business in the street. So I would not have set out to do it at all. But you never know what will happen in this life. And what happened to me in this life is that my beloved, my husband, the father of my children, very, very suddenly and unexpectedly died. And this was 3.5 years ago. Our sons were 12 and 13. So I put the story out there first to say it's the story that occasioned the work. It's the story that dictated the form of the work, because as I made my way through with my sons, I would steady my hand on the earth, on the table, by writing. That was the way I knew what I was experiencing. That was the way that I knew that I was still in some fundamental way myself, even though I had been shaken from my moorings. Mothering and writing were the two ways that I stayed afloat. And so I wrote a book that is a poet's memoir, which is to say that it's written in very, very condensed, short chapters. Among the many, 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 many things I learned from writing The Light of the World, and the privilege of being able to bear witness to this story, and the fact that I came prepared with craft to meet life and bear witness to it in this particular way, nothing more important has happened in my life as an artist. So I'm going to read some sections. The story begins on a Thursday night. I bring an unexpected guest home to stay with us, an artist friend who'd spoken on campus that afternoon. When I take her to the hotel after dinner, we find that it is in a deserted corner of town, far off the beaten track, so I offer to bring her to sleep in our guest room. She accepts with relief, and I call Fikre to let him know company is coming. When Lorna and I arrive home 10 minutes later, the house is lit and glowing, the kettle is hot, and tea is brewing in the black Japanese cast iron pot. Fikre has put raw almonds in a small celadon bowl. It is late. The boys are sleeping. We are so pleased to live like this, organized and open and welcome when friends pass through and we can bring them to Hamden, the hamlet adjacent to New Haven, where we recently moved to live in a tan stucco arts and crafts style house surrounded by a magic garden. Hamden, my first suburb, albeit a very urban one. Hamden, where Fikre fell in love with property that reminded him of the African compound where he grew up amidst flowers, inside walls his mother painted apricot, spring sky blue, rose violet, and butter yellow. The next morning, I organize the children for school and send them off, and Fikre makes coffee when our friend rises shortly after. We three drink our cappuccinos under the gazebo, which he painted in the delicate colors of the remembered borders of his mother's gauzy dresses and shawls. Some might take the colors for straightforward pastels or Monet water lilies, but they came from Africa and from his mother. Hanging inside the gazebo is a mobile he fashioned from some slender, twisty branches that blew down in the yard after a storm. The mobile turns gently in the breeze. The morning is gray, and the yard smells of the fresh, damp earth of early spring. As we walk toward the house, something makes us look back into the yard over our shoulders. There is a giant hawk sitting on the branch of our 100-year-old oak tree, eviscerating and devouring a squirrel. We freeze to watch. The raptor is utterly focused on its task. I watch Fikre and Lorna scrutinizing, their artist's eyes recording what they see. The hawk attends to its business undisturbed. It is rapacious. It takes what it wants. The bloody ribbons of the squirrel's entrails hang off the branch as the hawk eats the entire remains of the hapless rodent in about 5 minutes. Fikre tells us he has seen the bird the day before with the children and shows us a short video he took on his phone of the creature on the same branch eating another squirrel. I have seen a hawk a few times, but never one so intent on its survival. Never seen predation itself up close and in action. It is pure and elemental, necessarily violent, riveting nature itself. We watch for as long as we can before we have to go off to the duties of our days. Some weeks later, on his bureau, I find an acrostic Fikre made, which exhausted variations on the word hawk. He'd assign numbers to the letters and then assign those numbers to lottery tickets, which I later discover he bought by the dozens and secreted in the pages of the books he was reading. He was a chef and a painter. Henry Ford believed the soul of a person is located in their last breath, and so captured the last breath of his best friend Thomas Edison in a test tube and kept it evermore. That's true. It is on display at the Henry Ford Museum outside Detroit, like Galileo's finger in the Church of Santa Croce. But Edison's last breath is an invisible relic. Fikre breathed his last breath into me when I opened his mouth and breathed everything I had into him. He felt like a living person then. I am certain his soul was there. And then, in the ambulance, riding the long ride down to the hospital, even as they worked and worked, the first icy wind blew into me. He was going or gone. I need to call somebody, don't I? I asked the ambulance driver, a woman. Yes, you do, she said. In Lucille Clifton's poems, the living and the dead speak across the veil. Over the years, I have read those poems over and over, especially this one, The Death of Fred Clifton, age 49. I seemed to be drawn to the center of myself, leaving the edges of me in the hands of my wife. And I saw with the most amazing clarity, so that I had not eyes but sight. And rising and turning through my skin, there was all around not the shapes of things, but oh, at last, the things themselves. Was that what dying was like, a drawing into essence, a concentrated drop that would then evaporate off the earth? I seemed to be drawn, Clifton writes, in the voice of her dead husband. He cannot be sure what is happening. But the dead husband speaks from solid ground when he states in the poem that he is leaving the edges of me in the hands of my wife. We grasp at the tattered edges and don't let go. What we clutch is a rent garment, but it is ours and what is left now. The poem yields more as Fred Clifton moves closer to true knowing, as he sees with the most amazing clarity. Death itself is like a snake shedding its skin. Fred Clifton describes rising and turning through his skin. A new self reveals itself when the old carapace has shed and died, as though we live in exoskeletons with something truer underneath. Death comes with a gift in the poem. Our loved ones tell us here that what we see with our eyes is different from what we know, the things themselves. Oh, at last is the moment of exaltation in the poem. Lamentation and exaltation are simultaneous here. I am a widow. I am Ficre's widow, clutching at his edges. I cannot hold on to the garment. I cannot imagine what sight awaits me. He who believed in the lottery, he who did not leave a large carbon footprint, he who never met a child he didn't enchant, he who loved to wear the color pink, he whose children made him laugh until he cried, he who never told a lie, he who majored in physics, who knew the laws of the universe, he who wanted to win the lottery for me. I have to go to the studio and make sure it is secure. There could be flammable materials, turpentine. I don't know what I will discover. Two of my beloved students from the art school say they will come with me, Ronnie and Kenny. When we first enter, the life force within the space literally brings me to my knees. He is utterly present, but of course he is not present. He has left the studio tidy and ordered. I begin to take in what is in there, the hundreds and hundreds of canvases, not to mention the photographs, multimedia pieces, short animated films, charcoal and pastel sketches, and much more. I see that what he had been doing was creating an entire body of work, full and complete. I had seen each line and mark he ever made at some point, but taking in everything together is another thing altogether. He left us with his eyes on the world. Ronnie and Kenny dispose of what needs disposing, dried, stiff, paint-soaked rags, semi-full tins of paint thinner. Then they photograph everything inch by inch, which they later make into a collage for me. There is a painting on the easel he worked on his last day on Earth. It is a horseman in swift, energized brush strokes, and he is racing off the canvas toward something unseen, lightning quick. May 2011, Jason Moran and Michelle Ndege Ocello played Fats Waller, and we danced all night at the Harlem Gatehouse. Was it true that dancers moved among us holding outsized paper mache masks on sticks? Was it true that Michelle said to you from the stage, look at you, brother in pink, loving on your woman like that? Was it true Bobby O was there in a cream-colored jacket and a Papilindo hat? That night we danced in a fever, in a dream. The professional dancers came and took me by the hand and led me to the hypnotizing floor. It was the start of spring, blowsy and humid. Incipient. New York, New York, big city of dreams. Two springs later, I am searching the earth for you, four corners, finding you in a seashell in my underwear drawer, oregano and chives coming up in the winter garden after a few warm days, the pink argyle sweater folded in a cedar trunk, No, that is the sweater we buried you in. The winter garden is raised now, cleared, and you are no longer there, not this spring. April 1, April 2, April 3, April 4. No, start counting at your birthday party, March 30th, March 31st. No, start counting on your birthday when we brought you coffee and incense in bed. March 21st, your 50th birthday. Beloved. Every morning and every night, I open and close my eyes to Ficre's painting Visitation. It allegorizes our first meeting in the State Street studio when I walked through the foster kindness door into my future. In the painting, a man and a woman meet with offerings. From the woman, scarlet red tomatoes, her own fecundity held in cupped hands at her womb. She is wearing all white, the white of the Yoruba goddess Yemaya with her blue nearby in the background, and the white of Obatala, the creator of all human bodies. The solemn brown man humbly offers an eye on a plate. This is what Ficre gave all of us. We stand inside of him and have the privilege of seeing out as he did. The eye is also an icon, a protective evil eye that a caretaker offers his coming family. As in so many of his paintings, he has created a spirit house. Though the pair is meeting for the first time, they are surrounded by images of the children they will soon have, and their sons are painted as angels, for in Ficre's work there are angels everywhere in landscapes where ancestors are conjured and present. A curtain of flowers rains down on the woman's space, illuminating her. Visitation has Ficre's characteristic sense of what Amy called in his work Tutto, naming a kinship with the Italian artist Alighiero Boetti's maps of the world. They shared an unshakable belief in beauty, in overflow, in everythingness, the bursting, indelible beauty in a world where there is so much suffering and wounding and pain. And then to close. New York friends who loved Ficre come over to welcome us to our new home. We eat and laugh and drink and play music. Afterwards, I am so tired that I sleep unguardedly. Ficre comes to my dreams and has never been more vivid. He is excited. He has just been named the chef in the historical division of a great art museum. And I thought, like, I think that really happened. It didn't really happen, but it felt like it really happened. He is to invent dishes and to match pigments in paintings to their proper historical sources. He tells me the history of ochre. Ferric oxide, an impure clay, makes the color. He explains why it is red in Eritrea and yellow in southern France, the things he knew. How to make paper with suminagashi paper technique. Where there was a foundry in the Hudson Valley to do lost wax casting in bronze. How to butcher an entire lamb. How to clean a fresh chicken. How to marbleize paper and make tiny notebooks with covers the pink, gray, and greens of some remembered quarry. He loved that I was an American girl. Tall, sturdy, sunny, good teeth, optimistic, full of songs from the Negro canon and the great American songbook. He loved my blues, which saw the world but never laid me low. He knew more than I did that we were not meant to survive if not to profit for others, and that I came from survivors. Later that morning, I asked my sons, how can we be so happy when we have been through so much? The forest is not denuded. The trees are standing tall. In the dream, he picks up my coffee cup and examines it. I have purchased it since he died. He finds the curve of the handle and pale pink crackled glaze to be beautiful. Sit with me, my darling, he says, and have a cup of coffee. Thank you.
All for you, baby.
Good evening. It's good to see everyone. What a beautiful reading. As someone who saw his studio, it was so full of life, and we miss him. Sorry, I'm just getting my time down here. I also feel like saying, do you remember the 21st night of September? Because Maurice White is gone. I thought because of that and for many reasons, I'd start with the blues. This is a poem called Flash Flood Blues. going to be reading from Blue Laws. This is only the second or third time I've read from it. It came out yesterday. thank you. And it's 20 years of work, so I'm going to skip around a little bit, but really range across this time frame. So this is called Flash Flood Blues. Flash Flood Blues. I'm the African-American sheep of the family. I got my master's degree in slavery, immigrant to the American dream, evacuee. I seen the water ladder its way above me, swam to the savings and loan, no one home. I've steered hardship so long, even my wages of sin been garnished. Wolf tickets half off, collect call and response. Whenever we pass on the street, death pretends not to know me, though the grapevines say, he's my daddy. Thanks. So that's from a book called Dear Darkness, but I had turned to the blues earlier in a book called Jelly Roll, which was really, well, it wasn't my first foray into the blues, but it was my first foray as such. And the way I had almost finished the book before I realized that I didn't have any boasts in the book, which you got to have some boasts if you're writing a blues book. So here are a few. Boasts. Wouldn't be no fig leaf if I was Adam. Do I have to do that again? You know, you have to say it twice so people... Wouldn't be no fig leaf if I was Adam, but a palm tree. Once I danced all night till Dawn and I, who never did get along, decided to call a truce. My body buckets lighter, we shook hands and called it blues. Mama, I'm the man with the most biggest feet. When I step out my door to walk the dog round the block, I'm done. True story. So this book has a number of uncollected poems. I almost call them outtakes, but and there's a selection of Jelly Roll outtakes. It wasn't a short book, but it had at one time been longer, and I took out a bunch of poems, and now they sort of live in this form. So this one's called Hurricane Song. Hurricane Song. Lady, won't you wait out the hurricane all night at my place? We'll take cover like the lamps, and I'll let you oil my scalp. Please, I needs a good woman's hands caught in my hair, turning my knots to butter. All night we'll churn. Dawn will lean in too soon. You'll leave out into the wet world, winded and alone, knowing the me only midnight sees. I should have probably kept that one. This is called Chamber Music. Chamber Music. Woodwind. This morning, your mouth was all I could think about. Fiddle, like a violin, you leave the sweetest bruise just beneath my chin. Upright bass, love that place where your hip hits your waist and my head fits perfect, rests like music. Slide trombone, all day that scent in the crook of your neck distracts. Horns. Woke early, the light blues all in my bed, where I wish you warmed instead. Rhythm section. Without you, the room grown small. Only then can I see how each night we rocked a steady groove where the headboard hugged the wall. So skipping ahead, read from a book called Dear Darkness Again. This is a poem, an ode. There were a number of odes in it, and I thought I would read one. I went back and forth. I was going to give you a choice, but why not? I'll just read Ode to Pork, which is the first poem I could write after my father died. It was sort of like comfort food or something. So, Ode to Pork. I wouldn't be here without you. Without you, I'd be umpteen pounds lighter and a lot less alive. You stuck around my ribs even when I treated you like a dog. Dirty, I dare not eat. I know you're the blues because loving you may kill me. But still, you rock me down slow as ham hocks on the stove. Any way you come, fried, cued, burnt to within 1 inch of your life, I love. Babe, I revere your every nickname. Bacon, chitlin, cracklin, sin. Some call you murder, shame's stepsister, then dress you up and declare you white and healthy. But you always come back sauced to me. Adam himself gave up a rib to see yours pile pink beside him. Your heaven is the only one worth wanting. You keep me all night cursing your four-letter name. The next, begging for you again. Thanks. I'll just read a few more. The book has another set of poems for Phyllis Wheatley, the first African-American poet of the United States. So she had to go to England to publish her book, as you know, in 1773. And it's a long sequence, and all the titles are taken from her titles. And so I'll just read two of them. They're sonnets. This one's called To Mr. and Mrs. Blank, and that's how it is in the original, on the death of their infant son. Whatever the hour carried on that brilliant gray day when you married, you made the most of. A quiet kiss, a cry. No one threw rice. It was all you could afford, the clothes and the pastor secondhand. Inherited like you had, your freedom once the mistress, you wept, grew sick and passed. Months later, you lost your first. His small, fluttering chest, like a bird far fallen from the nest. His shy head the size of your opening fist. This is called Elegy on Leaving Blank. Elegy on Leaving. Presented with paradise lost in London by the mayor, your first and last triumphant trip there. You read Milton with care, knew his devil not as talk or fast hands, but silence. Your words that no longer arrive, your husband in debtor's prison to pay off first the house on Queen Street, your envious neighbors, then on Prince, where your third colic breathing babe grew cold and passed, where hours after you met your Lord, your beloved copy, and you only 31 years old, of paradise lost to eat long sold. Thanks. So, I'll end with just two more poems. This is a poem called Bereavement. It's from a book called Book of Hours. Now it's from this book. And it's about, it's a book that I want to return to my father's death and the days and hours after it. A Book of Hours, of course, as you know, is a little prayer book. It's intimate. And it was only after I had published it and I was talking to someone on the radio that I realized it was also, you know, O-U-R-S, our book. So this is Bereavement. Behind his bereavement. Behind his house, my father's dogs sleep in kennels. Beautiful, he built just for them. They do not bark. Do they know he is dead? They wag their tails and head. They beg and are fed. Their grief is colossal and forgetful. Each day they wake, seeking their voice, seeking his voice, their names. By dusk, they seem to unremember everything. To them, even hunger is a game. For that, I envy. For that, I cannot bear to watch them pacing their cage. I try to remember they love best confined space to feel safe. Each day, a saint comes by to feed the pair, and I draw closer the shades. I've begun to think of them as my father's other sons, as kin, brothers in paw. My eyes each day thaw. One day the water cuts off, then back on. They are outside dogs, which is to say healthy and victorious, purposeful, and one giant muscle, like the heart. Dad taught them not to bark, to point out their prey, to stay. Were they there that day? They call me like witnesses and will not say. I ask for their care and their carelessness. Wish of them forgiveness. I must give them away. I must find for them home, sleep restless in his all night. I expect they pace as I do, each dog like an eye roaming with the dead beneath an unlocked lid. And I'll end with a poem later in the book that sort of has a different tone. It's called Expecting. Expecting. Grave, my wife lies back, hands cross her chest, while the doctor searches early for your heartbeat, peach pit, unripe plum. Pulls out the world's worst boombox, a Mr. Microphone, to broadcast your mother's lifting belly. The whoosh and bellows of mama's body, and beneath it, nothing. Beneath the slow stutter of her heart, nothing. The doctor trying again to find you, fragile fern, snowflake, nothing. After, my wife will say, in fear, impatient, she went beyond her body, this tiny room, into the ether. For now, we spelunk for you one last time, lost canary, miner of coal and chalk, lungs not yet black. I hold my wife's feet to keep her here, and me, trying not to dive starboard to seek you in the dark water. And there it is, faint, an echo, faster and further away than mother's, all beatbox and fuzzy feedback. You are like hearing hip-hop for the first time. Power hijacked from a lamppost, all promise. You couldn't sound better, break dancer, my favorite song bumping from a passing car. You've snuck into the club underage and stayed. Only later, much, will your mother begin to believe you're drumming in the distance. Our Kansas City and Congo Square, this jazz band vamping on inside her. Thank you. Oh, thank you.
So we're going to self-rule.
We hope. Misrule.
So I had a starting point.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So I've been thinking lately about, I think about this phrase, staying the course, and what it means for artists.
Yeah.
You know, and what it means that we're here
sure.
after what's now been a long time, and some people are not here, but we're still here.
Yeah.
And not just still alive, but also still finding a way to make our work some kind of way.
Right.
I've been thinking also, because doing a different kind of work for a little while now, you know, what it means to be of the tribe of us.
Uh-huh.
And how precious the tribe of poet friends is
right.
to me. As I was flying over here, I was thinking, you know, like, Robin's flying this way, and Kevin's flying
right.
that way, and Terrence is flying this way, and we're all in the air
yeah.
doing our poetry thing, and we're all a community in some kind of way,
right.
looking at the world at an angle and finding a way to continue to do that.
Sure.
And that we've also generationally caught up with each other.
Do you have a question? Or
You know what?
Sorry.
You know what? I said I was going to make a little rhapsodic statement
really,
to get us started.
I really teased
since
it.
Some people didn't want to get us started. I thought I would just,
no,
you know,
I know,
take
I'm
care
playing,
of business. So what I was thinking about, and I'll wrap it up,
yeah.
But that now, like, we're all... So when I met Kevin, he was a college boy.
Yeah.
And I did a reading, and there you were. But like, we're all the same age now,
yeah,
you know,
right.
because I believe, because we've just, everyone's been just kind of staying the course, you know? So I don't know. I've just been kind of in that space of feeling, first of all, just so extra, extra grateful
sure.
to have made a life with this tribe.
Well, and it's changed. I mean,
yeah.
feel like, I mean, I remember vividly when... The Venus Hottentot, Elizabeth's first book, was in the terrific book, was in the New York Times Review, and I brought it to my little class and said, "We have to be reading this," you know, and I had to be reading that because it really, I thought, you know, I'm not going to get the metaphor right, but it sounded an alarm or it was a shot across the bow that you could write about history, you could be personal, but you could also be. Oneself. I mean, which I think, you know, all good writers say that, but it was the right moment for me to read that, and I think for, you know, the New York Times to read that. So that was really amazing to me, and I remember going to your reading with that book and sort of having you sign it and thinking about it as a kind of totem. But now there's so many totems. I mean, thank goodness.
Yeah.
I mean, I
yeah.
think because of a lot of the hard work of a lot of people, some in this room, some not in this room. And just going from sort of the dark room to Cave Canem to the sort of breadth of black poetry, you can't keep up. But you used to be able to get us
up.
All in one room. And
yeah.
If a bomb went off, you know, it would be the end of black poetry for a few years. But now there's so many, it's great, you know. But I think there was always that polyphony of voices and that real range of voices, but there wasn't always the structure to support them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that... is wonderful now to see that support. But I do think, like you're thinking, in a kind of existential way, how wild it is, you know, and how freeing and is it newfound or something? Or old found? I don't know what the...
Or just thinking about what does it actually deeply mean to be a poet all these years later?
Yeah.
You know, besides just writing some poems. And I think part of that is
right.
thinking, you know, we've both written prose.
Yeah.
And it's been a long time since I've written a lot of new poems, but still knowing that fundamentally I am a poet, that that's
sure.
the central identity. So I've been trying to think about what that means about
to be
how
a poet
we
or?
Yeah, about how what does it mean to how about how we are in the world, even in our different ways.
Wow, that's a good question. I mean, I don't feel as much a poet always as you. Definitely having the book come out, I feel differently. I feel both like panicked and, you know, the normal kind of a book is out. But then I also feel like, oh, yeah, like I did write poems, you know, because you can get far from it. I think so much of the job of being a poet is, especially a senior poet, I don't know what the heck to call,
mm-hmm.
but someone who's been doing it a while,
mm-hmm.
you get asked to write letters, you
yeah.
got to do the administrative
tithing
things,
yeah,
yeah. and yeah.
You, but you have to.
Ben Carson was right about...
What?
Tithing, he said we all, oh, okay.
Oh, no.
Sorry, I just had to throw it out.
You know, I said Ben Carson, you know, I a long time ago, I thought it was so cool that a brother separated the Siamese twins.
Yeah.
But as my father says, you know the twins are not doing well.
It's true.
But anyway, continue.
Lord. I should have never started. I don't know. There's so many things that take you away from poetry, let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Including life, including death. And so how do you get back to it? I think that's a really great question. The care and feeding of poets. And, you know, I often say to friends, I'm probably the one who goes around not heeding my own advice, but say, you got to get back to your poems. You know, you got to carve out that time and say some no's. And, but, you know, there's so much. I feel like I certainly felt like when I was doing anthologies, I really wanted to give back to that place that had nurtured me and those books that I had found in a used bookstore and thought, oh, there's other poets writing about food or history or things that I ended up taking up as my mantle or was already writing about but thought I was crazy for doing it. So I've been lately thinking about how often you find your ancestors or antecedents after you need them, like you've written the thing, and then later you're like, oh, you know, I wasn't nuts, but in a way, I don't think you could use them when you're trying to struggle and find it yourself. I mean, I don't know how
That's
you felt. Like you have, you know, how you go to the store or something, and the right book falls into your lap or hands, and you're like, oh, you know, I can't believe this, but it probably was there before, and you just didn't have the foresight or the room to do it, find it.
Well, I think that maybe that describes a little piece of what it means to be a poet, and maybe we can keep coming back to it. But I think there's a certain being open to serendipity, because if you're not, you miss the whole thing.
Sure.
And what does it mean to kind of walk that way every day in some kind of way?
But you know, in it's like that with relationships, you know, and just friendships. Like, I wouldn't have, what if I hadn't shown up to that reading, you know, which I can't imagine. But, you start to realize that you've been doing it a while and, you know, having a selected poems does that.
Well, I think also just in thinking and, you know, mentioning friendship, I think that one of the things that I feel so, just so fortunate is I think there's a way that, you know, and it's about the flying all over the place. We fall in love quickly. We fall in love with each other. We fall in love with our friends. We fall in love with our poet friends. We pick up where we left off. It doesn't matter how long it was.
Right.
We come right into the place of humor. We come right into that place of being enraptured with each other, and we overdo it. and that's really just a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I think so.
You know?
I mean, poems themselves do that in a weird way. Like, I think of poems of yours and different moments when I read them and how much they taught me about, you know, that moment. It's interesting because I remember seeing your selected poems and thinking, you're missing this blues poem. Or, you know, like, I missed some of those old friends and things I had taught and thought about and taught me, so...
So Kevin was the only friend. So I have, you know, all these poet friends, but I don't share my poems, and I used to share them with Fikre, actually, with my husband, and I just love telling the story of how I looked at everything he made, he looked at everything I made, and he was very, you know, kind of elemental in his response, and he would literally, he was not American, he was from Eritrea, and so he was a wonderful anthropologist of Americanness, and every now and again, if he liked it, he'd go, which was so funny, because that's not an organic gesture for him at all, but, you know, and I would read the poem, he would read the poem to me, I would read the poem to him, and he would say thumbs up or thumbs down, and that was the end of it, when he'd say thumbs down, and then he would, almost like a Ouija board, he would put his finger on a spot in the poem, and he'd say, like, that, it's right there. That's where the problem is.
Right.
And he was always right about it. And he didn't say anything else. And he didn't, you know, and he did it very, very, very quickly. But to Kevin, I show my manuscripts and showed my selected poems or when I was making it. Because really, how do you pick?
It's weird.
It's very, very weird. And there is a feeling now sometimes when I go back to the original books, I almost I couldn't forget. I think that was so good. What was I even thinking?
Yeah, sure.
But I mean, I think they're living things and we're living things, and so it changes.
And did he help you with the inaugural poem?
Thumbs up, thumbs down. And that was really tense because since that was written in a short period of time,
yeah. You know, How long was it?
Will you please like put your thumbs up? I mean, like he would not put his thumbs up. He just, And because there's a manuscript box, there's about that much draft of that poem.
Yeah.
You know?
Handwritten first or?
Handwritten first. And then, you know, in the computer printed out. Like 100 drafts or something.
Wow.
I don't know.
That's how many. I meant how much if I had to buy it tonight.
Buy it tonight. That's right. Write one of those
on the street.
Emory checks. But you know, when it was so pure and true that when you finally get there.
Yeah.
And it's just like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, okay.
Well, because I remember when you finished it.
What'd I do?
A holiday party.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Said, I finished it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was like, well, okay, let's hear it or whatever. But you wisely just waited to that day. And I think it was so.
I thought maybe it was against the law, actually. I thought maybe I would get arrested.
Yeah.
That there would some.
You never know.
You never know.
Yeah, you never
they're everywhere. Even the good ones.
Jump out crew.
They're everywhere.
Yeah.
But I think also in thinking about. You know, intersecting with other artists, people who make, I mean, you know, there's so much blues, there's so much food. What was it? Did you see what Michael Twitty said about soul food the other day on Twitter?
No, I didn't see that.
It was a really beautiful line. I wish I could remember it, but about like soul food is the edible aesthetic of, it's just something really lovely about black food and the culture of it.
Sure, yeah.
Something that we share, but that you have fully plumbed. And so I think about, you know, the art of cooking, the art of, you know, of Ellen Gallagher's involvement with the dark room in early days and just kind of always understanding yourself in conversation or relationship to other artists. It's not a question, it's just sort of a naming of something.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I don't know about you, you grew up with arts all around, I feel, and I didn't exactly. My parents were, you know, the first to go to college, and they lived in rural Louisiana growing up, and that was sort of my art, you know, was going down to Louisiana and seeing the farm and seeing the chickens, you know, and they weren't romantic, you know.
Yeah,
I was saying the other day, it's like they were farm to table, but we just didn't know it. I remember my mom came to visit me. I went to the McDowell Colony a few times, and she came and visited me, and she's walking in the piney woods, and she's like, I didn't know we grew up in an artist colony. You know, because it was very much like dirt roads, and it's still like that, you know.
Yeah.
So it has that earthiness. And, you know, for me, that was really what, I don't know about you, when you first realized, because it's a different thing. Like, for me, it was like, oh, I want to write. It was strange because I didn't know any writers really, or any poets certainly. But it must have been a different thing for you to decide to step out in a different way. But for me, it was realizing that my grandparents in that milieu was actually the stuff of poetry.
Yeah.
That poetry wasn't like air, but dirt, you know, mud.
Yeah.
And that was really important for me. And, you know, there were a lot of, like I said, there were antecedents. But you also have to have sort of models and anti-models.
Yeah.
And I think that was really important to find what I wanted to be like and then also what I didn't want to write like.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, I think that, you know, these are black stories. So, you know, there's always some angle of ascent, to quote Hayden,
know.
I mean, so I didn't grow up thinking I was going to be a writer. I grew up thinking I was being trained for something.
Oh.
You know, like to govern in some kind of way.
Right.
You know, not.
And you were.
Well, so being a writer was still a little bit of, and being a poet was a little bit of a surprise. It came to me later. I mean, that's when you talk about feeling apart from poems a little bit. I think like you were so full. You were a poet in college. I mean, you were. I mean, you were like a practicing poet, and I didn't know that about myself at that time.
Huh. Yeah, I think I felt like because my parents were serious, you know, they had sort of gotten out of Louisiana, not that Louisiana was a place to escape, but that they had, you know, you know, set out. It was like they were immigrants or something.
Yeah.
And so they had this kind of adventurous spirit, but they were also like doctor, you know, like decided to be a doctor or decided to be a chemist. My mom was the first black woman chemist to get a degree. She got her degree, I don't know, in the 60s. How many black women chemists are there, PhDs, period?
Hardly any.
Yeah. So, and, you know, this is, I mean, you know, I rarely meet people who grew up poorer than my parents, you know. It's like, did you have an indoor bathroom? You were richer than they were. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was always interesting to me to see how, you know, you didn't have a choice. You couldn't come home and whine about anything, you know.
Yeah, no.
You had to just get it done. So to me, yeah. I think that, like, I was like, I better write these poems
yeah.
before they figure it out that yeah. I'm, you know,
now that's when
that I'm not going to be a lawyer or something.
when people say, you know, oh, you know, were you so nervous? Do you think you might mess up at the inaugural or whatever? I'm like, you don't understand my parents. Like, you know, it's not an option.
Right.
To mess up when everybody has cleared a way.
That's interesting.
For you to do, you know.
So in a way that was, I felt simpatico that way with you.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I think also I'm thinking about your mom and chemistry and about, like, knowing and expertise.
Sure.
You know, and thinking about, you know, you never fully master, but the idea of having a discipline and something to try to master, to aspire to master.
Well, and there's a level of intuition and answers that she loves, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and chemistry gives you those, which is both poems and not poems, you know. Poems mm-hmm. don't always do that.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one formula,
mm-hmm.
But there is that kind of part of your brain that is not always on alert. You know, like there's mm-hmm. some subterranean part that I feel like, how did she figure that out? That mm-hmm. she was excellent at that, or
yeah.
Sometimes you wonder, you
yes.
know, what spirit. But I guess the other side is that, like, I just, you know, my grandfather played zydeco music, and this is his fiddle on the cover. Which I still have, and then it's nice.
So beautiful.
And there's a picture of him inside with his cousin and his play cousin, you know, posing with this fiddle. You know, like when you have that, you got to do something, right? You can't just not do anything.
Yes. No, that's so. Right. I think also when you talk about writing the letters and, you know, just trying and where the black arts have moved in the years that we've been
right.
making them and how important it's been to, you know, try to build something and try to be helpful.
Do you think it's built now?
It's not built. No. Because, I mean, you know, no. So much that has been built could evaporate tomorrow
yeah.
as far as institutions. Look, arts organizations could evaporate tomorrow. Right. So many of them.
Yeah.
So when you put together, like, black people and poetry and you think about what does it take or the arts in general,
yeah.
you know, I think the good news is that, you know, black people are survivors and poetry is tough grass.
Yeah.
So right. you can't, apparently we can't be exterminated, right? You know, despite efforts to, you know, yeah. the ongoing sure. efforts to the contrary.
Sure, sure.
But I mean, I'm serious.
No,
you know,
absolutely.
So too poetry, right? Human beings have declaimed for as long as there have been human
right.
beings. So that's not, so it persists, but I think that, I think the institutions are very fragile, and I think, you know, I get very excited when I see, I don't overvalue prizes, but I'm a student of them.
Yeah.
You know, when I see places where we were not before, where we weren't judges, where we weren't nominated, where we didn't win, and I see how so much is changing, and I think recognizing that, you know, right now, I think black creativity is certainly beginning to be recognized as being at the center and definitive and constitutive of American creativity at its best.
Yeah.
But I feel like just take away one head of an organization, or just, we know what happens at the end of these judging processes where suddenly there's a default to familiarity, or it could fall apart very quickly.
Sure. Interesting.
So I don't know. I just think it's just important to keep at it. But it does take time from the work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you thinking about next, or are you thinking about what's next?
I You know, I...
Because you're up for a prize, we should say, the National Book
yes.
Critics Circle.
So that's nice. That's nice. But you know, this book's been really interesting because it's, you know, it's because it has story that goes mm-hmm. before the writing. So many people have come to the story.
Yeah.
So they're the same people who might be interested in poetry or my poetry or our poetry, but then also there are all these people with all these stories.
Yeah.
So moving around with the book has been so beautiful.
Yeah. I felt that way about the grief anthology I did.
Yeah.
People still come up to me and they say, oh, I gave that, you know, 10 times to people.
I've given that book, yes.
So it's funny what connects. You don't always know, but you always hope, I guess.
Yep.
I think it's a beautiful book, and hearing those first pieces of it, when did you know it would be that structure?
I wrote little mm-hmm. pieces, and just like with books of poems, mm-hmm. I don't, you know, I would put them in a folder when they were done and not look at them for a long time because I was afraid I would jinx it if I went and looked and the folder was actually scant, you know, and then I'd think, oh.
So you're just forward.
So just like little piece, and I didn't understand it as a whole, actually, for some time. And then when there were enough, you know, Rita Dove talks about how, I can't remember if she talked about this in writing or if I heard her say this at a reading one time, that when she's putting together a book that she would put like red folder, blue folder, purple folder, yellow folder, and that she'd take her sheaf of poems and she'd walk around the room and say, you know, purple, you know, you're red. She would just make these very intuitive piles.
Really?
Yeah.
You can do that?
That's what I do. You know, she would... I'm being like... Rita, I'm being dramatic and fabulous. I have nails that are painted beautifully I am Rita for a moment. But that she would just say she wouldn't even ask herself she just knew that they were companions.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did when I had a bit of a stack.
Yeah.
And then there were really... I actually then started to really like the structural part because, you know, the sitting at my dining room table weeping every day for hours and hours writing, that was over.
Yeah.
And then it was just the fun... you know, like hard.
Sure.
And figuring out things like, I have to say up front, I have to describe this catastrophic thing first.
Right, yeah.
Because that's what occasions everything. And
Did you write that later, though, I would think?
I wrote it first.
Oh.
Eat the frog first.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I
avoid it till the end.
Yeah?
No, I mean, I don't know. Sometimes.
Well, but I mean, you know...
I don't remember when I wrote, like, Bereavement, which mm-hmm. wasn't the first poem, but I remember when it became a poem.
Yeah.
You know, I felt like it was much more like that. But maybe that's, like, the structure. There was a moment when it went from being, like, a thing I had written, which wasn't a poem, to a poem. And it was probably just, like, you know, adding the right stanza for
mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
mysterious.
When you found that structure, how long was that?
Well, there were a couple things. So first was figuring out, like, tell that story first. And then the next thing was stepping back a little bit. Because, I mean, again, I was still all the way through. I just thought, like, memoir. And that I didn't want to seem like, I knew I had written as well as I could.
Sure.
And I knew there was a story. But I also felt like, just like, you know, when I had my first child, my mother said, are you the first woman ever to have a child? She's cold like that. And she wasn't being mean, she was just being Adele.
I love that.
You know, because that's how you feel, like you're the first,
right.
You had a line like that, like you're the first time you listen to hip hop.
Yeah.
You know, like it's that amazing. It's sure, that amazing. Sure. So I didn't want to be like, I'm the first person to whom something awful happened.
Sure, yeah.
But I knew that, so then I knew that what I had to do in the writing of it was make these characters we had to know them, we had to know Fikre, we had to love them, we had to care about them, we had to care about this family.
Sure.
You know, I had to step out like that and say, how do I write these people in a way that people will want to stay with them through the book?
Well, it's really, I think, a love story, you know,
yeah.
So beautifully rendered those early months when I remember vividly you all meeting and you know, being there. So I think you really captured the feeling and the magic, you know, the intimacy.
Well, one of the things that I've been happy about is that a lot of young people have felt hopeful about love when they've read it. And we've talked a lot about that.
Right.
You know, because, I mean, well, because you also, having seen many ups and downs in my life, you know. Sure, sure. There are moments where you don't feel hopeful. There are moments where you can't imagine that something so beautiful could not only be around the corner, but be so damn simple.
Yeah.
Right. At a certain level.
Right.
You know?
Well, I think the writing in the book is simple.
Yeah.
But not, I mean, those lottery tickets are so powerful and true, but they're also about, you know, much more. I mean, I think maybe I'm overstating, but for me, I really wanted, when I was writing about my father and my son being born, to capture in the moment, make the metaphor out of the experience.
Yeah.
Like have his dogs tell the story.
Yeah.
And not me tell it, if you know what I mean.
Yes. Yes. So I don't know what's next is really the answer, although I think it's maybe some essays.
Yeah.
That's what I'm thinking about.
Just but on only culture? Because I love The Black Interior.
Yeah,
this isn't your first nonfiction, but it's your first sort of memoir.
Yeah, memoir. yeah, probably but culture and probably stuff that comes from many, many years of teaching.
Yeah.
And just like thinking about what it means for some of those conversations to kind of come into form. And how about you?
I am finishing, I hope, soon, a nonfiction book about liars. But
so cool.
It's very long because there's a lot of liars. I'm trying to cut it down, but these people keep lying, man. I mean,
keep lying.
I'm really trying to resist the election cycle in that regard.
Yeah, right?
It's real tough.
There is trickeration everywhere.
It's real tough.
And is liar, because I remember for a while the word was hoax.
Yeah, I'm lying when I say it's about liars.
Okay.
It's really about hoaxes.
Hoax.
Yeah.
You get to even write that word over and over
again. Yeah, it's a great word.
It sure is.
So, so that's a big project. It's sort of a little bit, the Gray Album, which was my first nonfiction, was like the good side of lying, and this is the bad side. And so, and then I think eventually there'll be, because, you know, that book's about storying or sort of what we used to call, you couldn't say you lie to someone in Louisiana, you'd have to say you story.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's interesting, because I imagined, because I, not having seen this, the new work, I think of it as, in my head, I put it in a different place.
Yeah, it is very different.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to reconcile that, like, you know, it's okay to say it's bad. I think I'm so used to, you know, rooting for a thing. So it was interesting, you know, because I wasn't going to write a book about 400 years of African-American production and say, you know, well, it was bad or didn't exist or...
Yeah.
Which there's many books like that.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Sort of back to what we were saying, like there's a book called Modernism. I think it's Peter Gay.
Oh, yeah.
And there's not one black person in it.
Isn't that something? I know.
And it's 500 pages.
Up on a shelf with a whole lot of other 500-page books.
One of Manet's mistress is half mm-hmm. black, maybe. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so that's an example.
Yeah, she's the only, you know, half of her is black. And that's, you know, it was like he just kind of, you know, just gone. And you see that, like, the renderings of what the avant-garde is like often end up all white, which is strange.
Yep, yep.
And not, you know, how I think they thought of it.
Yep.
They loved African and oceanic and however you want to think of it, art.
Well, that's what I love about, like, scholarship and university life and thinking and that even not necessarily by scholars, but scholarship that says, you know, and that in teaching that when you can say, okay, it's 1945.
Right.
You know, or it's 1935 and Gwendolyn Brooks is a poet coming of age in Chicago. And what else is happening in Chicago?
Sure.
You know, and guess what? Like these people were aware of each other and it wasn't just all of the black people all together all the time, although sometimes it was. But I mean, people, lo and behold, they read things. Lo and behold, anyone can open up a book.
Right.
People looked at things. People went places. People crossed boundaries. People had friendships.
Sure.
You know, it's
But don't you think that silo thing is, I mean, it's sort of how we're taught. It's sort of how some people teach. But I also think it's easier, tidier somehow. And the messier truth still hasn't been written, I don't think, about the 20th century and poetry. I'm a curator of this poetry library, and you just see these connections. This person published that person, slept with that person.
Yeah.
There's a letter that I had known we had it, and I'm doing a beat exhibition in a couple years. And so there's going to be a lot of Bob Kaufman, the wonderful poet in there. But we have this letter from Jack Kerouac to Owen Dodson, the African-American writer, wonderful writer, and it's about his novel, A Boy at the Window, and it's the most praising letter you've ever... He said, you don't know me yet, but I've written one good book,
Town in the City.
And, you know, you might read it, but it doesn't matter. You know, it's like, I probably took a picture of what he says. He says the most amazing things to this, these two young writers writing, and he's like, you are incredible. I've shared it with everyone. You're going to be huge. And, you know, now most people might not know who Owen Dodson is.
Wow.
You know? And there it is. Evidence, that trail is so telling.
Well, I mean, we share an archival love, but to me, stories like that are what it is to be alive and a thinker. You know, I mean, it's just, what could be more exciting than that?
Right. And he wasn't like, I'm going to be in an archive one day.
Right.
He was like, I have to tell this other person how great they are.
Yes. So.
Well, I should say how great you are. So.
And how great you are, baby. So we went a little bit past our time.
We do have time for one or two.
We have time for a few questions, if there are any. Oh, lights are up.
Yeah.
Goodness, I get the first question. Thank you both so much. You both call on dreams often in your poetry, and I just wondered, I was thinking, just reading today, Elizabeth, of your earlier work, do your dreams ever desert you for periods of time? I mean, are they always there for you? Can you always call upon them in your work, and you, Kevin, or do you have times that are like devoid of dreams and you can't make them happen? I mean, literally,
well,
the
that's
dreaming life.
Actually, it turns out, after my husband died, I didn't dream for a really, really long time for the first time in my life. And I didn't dream of him for a very, very, just a few dreams. And the first time I dreamed of him, it terrified me so much, it woke me up wailing because I realized that it wasn't true, because my dreams are very true to me. So I think that it's some very powerful animal part of the psyche that just said, you know what, like, we're not going to make these for a little while because you are bereft, like, and bereft meaning like to be without in some kind of way. Yeah.
I think when my father died, I kept waiting for like a visitation or some kind of vision, nothing. And there was later, it was a little like that. I remember one time, but in the dream, he was dead. You know, it wasn't like he was alive and then we were talking about him being dead.
Yeah.
And that was kind of intense, you know, I mean.
Yeah.
So I have a line in a poem, you know, like, even in dreams you are dead, you know.
Yeah, I
and
remember that.
And that's, you know, that was painful, but, you know, sometimes they come and tell you it's okay and sometimes they don't, and you have to figure that out on your own, I guess.
Yep.
No, but yeah, I mean, right. I don't think I've written about them the way you have. I think you've really embodied them in some of those books, and the Antebellum Dream Book, among many.
Well, it always seemed to me that dreams were just the most interesting place to go, you know, and that also, if there were strange juxtapositions of things in dreams, that also there were strange juxtapositions of language, and that was really that's the space you want to be in for writing poetry. And I think about like a word like hoax, for example, and that sometimes a great word like that, a word with an X, a word with a diphthong, a word with like that it could just go floating in through a dream, and you'd wake up with it on your tongue in the morning and think, I want to do something with that.
Yeah. Well, I think Lucille Clifton is a great...
Yes, our beloved
purveyor
Lucille.
Of that, you know?
Yes. What if you had not preserved her legacy in the way that you have?
Well,
you know, I mean, for what it took to bring her papers to Emory, to keep them safe, to retrieve things, to make them proper, you know, and then to do her collected poems and other things that you know, exhibits. I mean, like that, that's just such... necessary work. We would not have the Lucille Clifton we have if you didn't do that work.
Well, thank you. But I think, you know, Lucille will, I think, outlive us all. And
I think she will, too. I think she will, too. But as we all know, as with the Owen Dodson letter, people aren't taken care of...
When Dodson, we have his archive at Emory,
It was at Yale.
No.
I didn't know that.
She thinks everything's at Yale. I want you to know. If I say,
no,
oh,
it's a sad story because I think he went to the drama school, didn't he?
I don't know.
Yeah, so I think it's a failed story of the institution.
I think it's a success story.
That's right. There you go.
Question over here.
This question is for Elizabeth. It's not about your recent memoir of loss, but a poem of loss. Your poem, When, and I wanted to know what was the moment that prompted you to write it.
Yeah, thank you. In the early 1980s, the black men were divine. I'm like the baby sister of the first wave of the AIDS generation, and those were my big brothers who showed me the way. In so many ways. I studied dance very seriously when I was younger, and those were my teachers, and those were my friends. And I mean, again, just like the, big brother generation, and that's the generation that you revere more than anything because they're proximate. And then they just were gone. So there's the poem. Yeah.
I was struck by your Owen Dotson story, and I wondered if each of you might suggest some writers that we might not know about that we should be reading.
Oh, you probably got all.
You should start, yeah.
So many. Call out. People out here have some names. Larson. Nella Larson? Yeah, Nella Larson. Oh, my God. Amazing if you haven't read Quicksand or Passing. Talk about modernism, right?
Right.
I mean, yeah, who else?
Octavia Butler.
Great choice.
Is a great, great, great choice. I think, she's very well known, but she's not enough known. My person, Gwendolyn Brooks. I mean, I think she's not enough read. When you talk about, kind of telling the story in a different way, I love when I talk about her work saying, that she's... the finest poet of the 20th century, bar none. I'll fight you on it. Of course, you can make the case for someone else. You can make the case for someone else, but I can make the case for Gwendolyn Brooks. But she doesn't get talked about in that way.
Sure.
Just like when Alice Walker made the grave marker for Zora Neale Hurston in the Field of Weeds, and she called her a genius of the South. Yeah. That word that's not used. To describe what black women do and who they are. Gwendolyn Brooks, a genius. So to read her thinking, I'm reading a genius. I'm reading someone who can outwrite T.S. Eliot. Yes, she can. I'm reading someone who overwrites Wallace Stevens. Yes, she did. I'm sorry. So I just think that bringing that lens is actually exciting because then it means that you say, well, what else, as you're asking, well, what else?
Yeah.
What else? Is there anything? There's so much we could add.
Yeah, so many great weirdo poets that I love,
Yeah, a lot of weirdo poets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I love a poet who's still alive. He's in his 90s, I think, Russell Atkins.
Yeah.
He's out of...
But how do you kind of, it doesn't... I don't... I think
great,
it's fascinating, but it doesn't...
He has a great poem called Spiritual with a Y.
Uh-huh.
And it's just up, and you just see it on the page. It looks like a musical score almost.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think you're reacting with a different part of oneself. I mean,
yeah,
it can't
yeah.
always be soul food or.
Yeah, no, that's true.
But all
that's
food
true.
Is soul food, if it's any.
There you go. Actually, also, we should probably say, because we both love him, Christopher Gilbert.
Yes.
Christopher Gilbert wrote a great book called Across the Mutual Landscape, and he's a poet who. Were he living, he'd probably be 65, maybe-ish.
Yeah.
He died about 10 years ago. He published Across the Mutual Landscape in 1984 with Grey Wolf. It was a cult book,
Yeah, people pass that around.
Ooh, yes, you'd yes,
find
yes.
It and then he didn't have a second book till last year when Grey Wolf did a compendium of all... His unpublished and the published.
With an introduction by Terrence Hayes. And it's just this big, full, generous vision and voice. Doesn't sound like anybody else. What's the title of the poem? Poem with Stevie Wonder in it. Poem with, I think it's got a title like that. But just this kind of, I feel like, no Ross Gay without Christopher Gilbert.
Right.
You know, no, I mean, he's beautiful.
Well, and I think there's that to be said. There's people who had this huge influence, but we didn't always, you know, there's a lacuna there.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I was obsessed for a while with that idea of the shadow book, the book we don't know is there, but is there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he like casts a shadow, and that second book of his, you know, is kind of that kind of shadow book. But luckily we have it now, and you can get it and read it.
Yes, yes, yes.
Fran Ross.
Oreo,
yes. Is that going to be made a movie? Did I hear that? Did I make that up? I think.
Starring who?
Let's cast it. We're in L.A.
Yeah. Don't put it up for an Oscar, though.
Oh!
Did I do that?
But you know what? Are we going to talk about the Oscars? Because I have one, like, very blasphemous thing to say.
Oh, no.
Well, no, it's what we all know. I mean, what we all know is that it's not the Oscar. It is the Oscars per se, but it's the industry. But what I feel is like, give me some more to choose from. So I'm actually don't hate on Will Smith, but don't tell me that's, you know what I mean? Like, or the don't say that the few little scraps that are out there.
The problem is Spike should have gotten it for X. And I meant like X as in anything, but for X specifically. No nominations. You know what I mean? Like just.
Yeah, no, over and over and over.
The whiteout or blackout, however you want to think of it, persists. So this is more the norm, actually.
Yep.
But Halle Berry got hers, man.
Another question from the audience?
Hello. As you have encountered new stages in your life, I'm wondering, how do you maintain your poetic authority?
Wow, what an interesting
question. And do you mean just moving through life stages or something more particular?
Rising.
Mm-hmm. Huh, wow. Up, up, up.
In a career sense? No, I think you're saying something interesting, and I want to hear more of what you're saying.
In aligning to your path upward. As a human and mm-hmm. as a lover of life.
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Beautiful.
How do you do that? That's a great question.
Yeah.
I think it's the question in many ways. Like, how do you keep at it? I think it's, you don't think of that big thing sometimes.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to write the next poem. The next line, the next word, especially when, you know, lover of life, but then you're facing with death or something or loss, mm-hmm. or we all have our losses. And so how do you deal with that? And I guess it's in little bits, you know, it's going to a reading, it's writing a word a day, you know, getting at that kind of, I don't know, process. I guess that's to me the big thing that saves me. If you start thinking only of books or the end result, you can get in your own way.
Yeah.
If you start thinking about process, and you have to kind of love that. You have to love words to paper, but also, you know, more words crossing out, like the kind of mess of it. Because sometimes that's your only reward, you know. I've definitely written poems that I thought were going to be something they didn't. I wrote books that I feared. You know, when I wrote that back, you have to kind of love that. You have to love words to paper, but also, you know, more words crossing out, like the kind of mess of it. Because sometimes that's your only reward, you know. I've definitely written poems that I thought were going to be something they didn't. I wrote books that I feared. You know, when I wrote that Basquiat book, I remember thinking, I'm going to have to throw this in the fire, you know. Mm. And I remember I wrote this Jack Johnson sequence. And I called up Elizabeth, and I said, oh, I wrote this sequence. No one really likes it. And next day, I got, like, a phone call from an editor who, you know, who said, I hear you have this poem. And it was because Elizabeth had told someone, and then Charles Rowell published it all. And that was such a blessing for me because I was ready to just put it to the side and move to a whole other thing. Or, you know, I didn't know what to do.
It's such a great, great poem.
Well, thank you.
And also, it's a poem that when I read it, and this is one of the tests among loved ones, I was so jealous. I was so jealous in the good way. I thought, you know.
But I couldn't have written it without your Ali poem. You know, I remember she had this great, as you know, Ali poem. You know, and I remember vividly hearing you read it. And you said it used to be 15 parts, but now the heavyweight round, it's 12 rounds, so it's 12 parts.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, oh, shit, that's smart. You know? Like
poetic structure from the Boxing Association.
Yeah, it was great. So I think it's things like that that have to get you going and keep you going. Yeah.
Yeah, process. It's just so true. And the only thing I would add to that is that's about staying very much present in the moment. You know, so I don't mean to be kind of like Buddhist light, but I mean that principle of being very, very present. I saw my poetry teacher was Derek Walcott, and one of the things that was amazing that I learned from him is that here he was this, you know, great, great, great accomplished artist, but every day it was about a blank page, and that for him the metaphor was St. Lucia, where he's from, you know, the waves, any markings in the sand, the waves wash them clean. And so you start all over again. You look out at the horizon, and you start from scratch. And you're always humble, you know, writing against the ages. And that the only way you can write against the ages is by staying in the moment. I think also so, too, you know, for both of us, the privilege of parenting it is also, there's a way in which your children will keep you in the moment. And that's just a hard place to be sometimes, a gorgeous place to be sometimes, but like the place to be, the truest place, I think.
So lovely to see both of you.
Hello.
In talking about process, I was just wondering your thoughts on language as a way of knowing and how language helps us to navigate and explore and not shy away from the ineffable, especially something as frightening as death and loss.
Wow. Y'all are saving the big questions for... that's a good question. I mean, I think a lot about wordlessness and jazz, say, which... to me, tells a story, but uses silence to tell it. Mm. And I find that instructive, whether it's in a line of poetry or thinking about even essays, you know. So there's the kind of gaps and silences we're talking about, but I think then there's also the, you know, befriending it. I feel like that's what Bob Kaufman did. You know, he always said, mm-hmm. oh, you know, I want to disappear. I want to be not remembered. I want to be buried in an anonymous crater on the moon. But he also was then, you know, fighting the silence at sort of every turn. I think hip-hop does that. But it's obsessed with silence and kind of noise and nihilism, but as a life-affirming kind of thing. So to me, there's a lot of approaches to it, but looking back and stepping back at African-American culture, to me, the blues, too, are this amazing thing where the part of it is naming it. You know, you're not, like, using euphemism. You're using wordplay and double meanings, but you're not, like, there is no death, you know, everything's fine. You have to say it, you know, last kind word blues or, mm-hmm. you know, death letter blues. I got a letter this morning. Mm. You know, how do you reckon it read? That's not a good letter, you know.
Yeah.
And to say that is to prepare us for what the I in that song, Sunhouse song, is about to open. You know, said the gal I love is dead. You know, and you know, hurry, hurry. It says, and that kind of is that nihilistic or is that, you know, is that realistic? So it's that tension, I think, that I find in the blues, and I find it consoling. You know, when I'm super blue, the blues fight that, you know. And music, to me, at its best, has that quality, and poetry, to me, you know, has that music built into it. Mm-hmm. I don't know, sometimes it can be too much, you know. Mm-hmm. Were you able to read at when in those moments? I like couldn't, you know, like mm-mm. when I lost my friend Philippe Wamba, the late great. He was 31, like Phyllis Wheatley. Mm. And I could only listen to reggae music. I could only listen to Bob Marley. Mm. And so that's why those poems ended up with Bob Marley titles, you mm-hmm. know. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this is answering the question so much as sort of trying to think about, you know, and I think we need to think about it more. How do we write about that mm-hmm. in a space and world where there are losses, there are injustices? How do you make that sound about it? I mean, I think a book like Citizen mm-hmm. does it in such a powerful way.
Yeah.
And she does it through, you know, something experimental yet accessible. I mean, those things aren't contradictory. And
yes.
So I don't know. I think we're all doing it in different ways. And, you know, just writing is part of that, sitting down and having the faith to do that.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about this thing that Anna Deavere Smith says about her working practice of interviewing people and making plays out of them. And she said that her grandfather said to her, and this was by way of teaching her about kind of old school black recitation. And he said, if you say a word enough, that word will become you. Mm. If you say a word enough, that word will become you. And I think that, you know, that like understanding words to your question about truth as bodily things that you know when they're true or when they're not is something that I think poetry does have a very particular inroad to, because sometimes poetry does carry content and meaning, but that's not its primary purpose. Its primary purpose is to come out of the body as music in some kind of way, as song. And I think that that you measure that in quite a visceral way. You measure it here, not just here, you know, and although our brains are in our bodies too. I think that kind of like, you know, measuring truth not by content, is it a lie or is it not,
yeah.
but rather by a kind of deeper knowing.
Well, sounding true. I don't mean...
Sounding true.
True-ish. I mean like...
Yeah, exactly. Sounding true. Like the golden earth, wind, and fire gong.
I know.
Yes.
Amen.
Amen.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you, darling.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.